Well, hello, good afternoon, Slanja Felcha, and welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM for another Thursday afternoon. My name is Scotty Hertz, and I am at the controls today in the secret Hertz bunker at an undisclosed location in Guelph. And from another undisclosed location in Guelph, I am joined by Adam A. Donaldson, Guelph Politico, and the chief assignment editor of this very show. Adam, how are you today?
Oh, I'm okay, all things considered, in COVID-adjusted terms and stuff.
Yeah, there is that. Do you have this thing where it's like you just kind of forget for a minute that everything that's going on, and then it's like, oh, and that comes racing back? I find this more often than not these days, but...
Yeah, that sounds vaguely familiar.
Sounds about right?
Yeah.
We're still getting blasted by the horns here. Anyway, I will... adjust the horn volume to a volume that we can work with. Today on the show, oh my God, once again, a full slate. We are going to talk about the, let's call it the statue situation. It obviously involves far more than statues and monuments that has been going on in Ontario in particular, Toronto specifically, and Oakville. Before that, we're going to talk a bit about the CERB and the work week. And are there people that are staying home and just getting the CERB and being slackers, or is there more to that story? Before the break, we're going to talk a bit about the Me Too, let's call it the Me Too situation in Quebec that is emerging, and it is emerging like a steamroller through lots of different sectors in Quebec, including the political sector, which is what we will focus on for the most part. But off the top, we're going to talk a bit about Trump's secret police force, who seem to be making great strides across America, starting in the West Coast in Portland and moving to anywhere where there's a Democrat mayor or a Democrat in charge. And for the most part, the people in charge are women. It seems to be where Trump wants to send these troops. But are they troops? This is the thing. There's a lot of uncertainty as to who these people are. They have no markings. They are the federal police force of some description that Trump can send wherever he wants, it would seem, which wasn't the original intention for this force. If I understand it right, it came out of 9/11 and that situation, having the ability to mobilize and take down terrorists, not a bunch of moms that are protecting their kids who are pro Black Lives Matter, or just standing around on the street, or trying to provide medical attention to somebody. It sounds like these police, and I use police in quotation marks, are just hauling whoever in and taking them away. I haven't actually heard any of the story of the aftermath of these people that are taken away. Are they let go? What have you heard, Adam? I assume they're let go, but I don't...
I had read this story of one woman who was part of the moms, the Wall of Moms, and she was taken into custody. She was basically held overnight and then was kept in frankly, solitary confinement. It sounded like a small room about the size of a prison cell or even smaller than that. And then was let go in the morning. She was never Mirandized, which she was a lawyer, so that caught her off guard, that nobody read her rights. Nobody told her what she was being detained for. And of course, the bigger point of concern is that who these people were specifically, actually both specifically and generally, like in terms of what service were they a part of, what branch, what office, and then personal identification, because, you know, when we see police officers out and about in our own community, they have badges with their own individual numbers on it. They have name tags that have their name and rank on it. So, I mean, that's not because they're... Well, I suppose if you're a police officer, you probably do carry a certain pride of being part of the service, but at the same time, it is also a matter of transparency, so that if you have a problem with this officer who may be detaining you, you can make a note of their name and their rank and their badge number so that you can report them to proper authorities later. And none of that is happening here. And that is especially scary if you believe that you live in a free country and you are peacefully assembling and using your right to free speech.
And Trump, of course, is saying that these his team have done a fantastic job. Now, as we know, the election is about 100 days out, give or take, 3 months away. And it's fairly obvious that this is the law and order president trying to establish himself in some way. It looks like it's backfiring spectacularly. I'm sure that there are deep people within deep roots of the base who are like, oh, it's, you know, go beat on those hippies or whatever. But the general impression is like, what this is the police state writ large. This is something you don't expect to see in America with its freedoms. And this isn't to say it's kind of weird that there's what's prompted this in terms of Black Lives Matter. A lot of it is to do with Black people in America's encounters with police. So then there's this other layer going on now where there's these, well, we'll call them the secret police for lack of a better title for them. As you said, no markings in that. And regular police are known to do that too, cover the badges. There are tricks of the trade. Mm-hmm. But this is way more like deep state stuff, showing up in rented vans, not speaking to anybody, just sort of in and out, dressed fully like soldiers. There's no question. And flat, like as I mentioned, the wall of moms who emerged to protect their kids. And supposedly there was some, I don't know, they were calling the dads, but I saw one. I actually initially thought it was the Onion, the dads going out with leaf blowers, trying to blow the tear gas away from the moms, assuming this is the partners or whatever. Absolutely nuts. So Chad Wolf, who I'd never really heard of, he's acting Department of Homeland Security Secretary, was on, you know, doing a scrum or whatever, and he's like, "Well, we don't need an invitation to do what we're going to do. We're just going to do it whether these people like it or not." It seems this guy was like some kind of longtime lobbyist, and then he joined the you know, ever-changing Trump team. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if he's spearheading this. He's definitely one of the players in this, but it's strange to see this kind of stuff coming from not a nobody, but this guy appears from virtually nowhere and starts in on the whole, well, we're just going to do it anyway. And then was it the other day Trump was talking about sending the officers, we're going to send them to Chicago. We're going to send these people to Chicago immediately. And Mayor Lightfoot was out saying, you know, just go ahead and try it. She's had a couple of press conferences on this. And it sounded like they had come to some kind of agreement saying, okay, these people aren't going to go around in unmarked vehicles on patrol. But she also said that doesn't mean that Trump isn't going to try this. So right. It might be like, oh, yeah, we'll agree to that. And then it'll be like, no, actually, you know what? We can do what we want. We're just going to haul whomever in because we need to protect our stations. What are they actually protecting in Portland? Well, like, it's not statues. It's like it's their headquarters, right?
Right, they were essentially the role of these people, are like of federal officers, is that they can respond to things happening in like in their jurisdiction, which would essentially be outside or inside federal buildings. Anything else on the streets of Portland, that's the responsibility of the Portland Police Department, unless, you know, there have been orders to override that, like if the governor were to call in the National Guard to augment the police force or something like that in the wake of a natural disaster, which has not happened. So, yeah, technically these people from Homeland Security are allowed to operate around federal buildings. However, there are, you know, the buildings like the federal courthouse in downtown Portland are surrounded by steel fencing and concrete barriers. So there, you know, there's been a reported $50,000 worth of damage to that building. So, I mean, that's petty cash for when you have a $1 trillion defense budget. But at the same time, yeah, so you can understand maybe them taking extra precaution. But what's happening and how this kind of started was that people were out demonstrating or having protests or sit-ins or something in other parts of Portland, where technically no federal officer has authority, and along come these people, unidentified, in unmarked vehicles, scooping people up. And this is kind of what the Chicago mayor was getting at. It's like, yeah, we can have you come in and set up your posts around the federal buildings and protect them because those are, you know, targets for protesters who want to demonstrate. Yeah, of course. But what seems to be happening is, Homeland Security's been given an inch, and it's taken a mile, and then it takes another mile. And then you get to the point, like what happened in Portland, where the a lot of the property damage and the, I don't want to say violence, because violence seems wrong, but like a lot of the really angry protests had seemed to die down until the Lone Ranger squad comes in, and then all of a sudden everybody's back on their nines because people are being tossed into unmarked vans. So they're actually doing more harm than good, which is why one of the reasons why the support is not there. Things have kind of chilled out, and people are now on the long, hard road of you know, negotiating properly with people in authority. The street-filled protests aren't happening so much. But yeah, it's a political calculation, because I think Trump and other people like Chad Wolf, who I'm pretty sure 50% of the reason why he's Homeland Security Secretary right now is because his last name is Wolf.
And well, that's because cool. His name was Chad.
So they think it's a political winner for them. They think they're going to get, you know, housewives in suburbia, good and scared of, you know, like these people outside. I can't remember where it was, but the two people who came out with their guns to greet protesters.
Oh yeah,
by.
In St. Louis.
Yeah,
and they've been charged with like bad handling of guns, among other things, which was well earned, because their gun technique was really, really crappy. But one of the key problems with Trump is that he's basing his policy on what he sees on Fox News rather than reading the daily briefing, which it's by all accounts he does not do. So in terms of This policy is pretty much on the fly, and I'm fairly sure that there's a, you know, couple little lackeys behind the scenes saying, yeah, you should do this, you should do it. It'll be great. It'll be great for ratings, right? It won't be great for anything else. It sounds like it's harming his reelection chances. But some of the stuff he's been saying, like, you know, it's all about the extreme radical left. And it's always Antifa or the anarchists. So he's got his usual two or three scapegoats that he goes to, right? But I mean, this is pure stagecraft, really, right? And
Ann Applebaum calls it performative fascism.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it, because that's exactly it. And did I see it right this morning that the mayor of Portland was gassed? Like he was out speaking to,
Yeah, the mayor of Portland was gassed. He was out, like, talking to protesters, and they were, you know, at times booing him, as you can imagine. He's an authority figure. He's doing his part to try and uphold the status quo, so understandable. But, yeah.
At least he's trying.
He's trying to talk to protesters, and then along comes Homeland Security and gasses everybody, including the mayor of Portland.
Yeah, and it doesn't sound like they're going to stand down anytime soon. Another city that was mentioned was Albuquerque. I guess anywhere, like you said, anywhere that there's a federal building of some description, it probably doesn't even have to be anything, or it probably doesn't even have to have anything happening out in front of it. Whether it's people painting Black Lives Matter on the road, is that considered, you know, an affront? I'm not sure. So,
well, Albuquerque is interesting because it's in New Mexico, and New Mexico is a swing state. And this is where people start sweating about election interference and whether this is like laying the groundwork for that stuff, because there are a lot of Democratic cities in big red states or even purple states like New Mexico. And so is Homeland Security going to be flooding the zone with stormtroopers as we get closer to Election Day under the auspices of, like, we have to protect the election, when they're really going to be, you know, rounding up anyone who isn't going to look like they're on Team Trump. I mean that all sounds like crazy conspiracy talk, but you know, when you have people being thrown into unmarked vans, literally, it's hard not to start thinking that way.
Yeah, this is some of the strangest electioneering possibly ever in the United States. I'm sure they've had their moments in the past, but at least in the modern era, it's shaping up to be pretty bizarre, and it doesn't look like it's going to go away anytime soon. So
Want to say, too, haven't heard anything from the NRA crowd, the militia crowd, the people who thought that military exercises in Texas in 2015 were going to lead to martial law. Like, those people who are literally on guard for tyranny in the streets, government going crazy, snatching up your power, overriding people's rights. Those people are profoundly silent right now.
Yeah, and it's okay when it's the rights of the so-called Antifa anarchist lefty whatever squad, right? When it's them, it's all right. Well, we'll let that go. But when they want to take our guns away, and I'm surprised the so-called militias and the right-wing nut bars with their pistols haven't been out yet. But if they haven't been, they probably will be soon. As to whether they will get hauled away remains to be seen. So turning to the north now and to Quebec, our neighbors in Quebec, there's been quite a bit of activity recently beyond the story that we were going to discuss about Premier Blanchet, or not Premier Blanchet, sorry, Bloc Québécois leader Blanchet.
Yeah.
There's been an accusation put to him. It was initially on Facebook, I believe. That of a Me Too accusation of something that had happened back in 1999. Now, in looking into this, it turns out they're having what they're calling a, well, not a reckoning, but the denunciation, which of course is denunciation. I was reading a couple of the Quebec papers. The mass denunciation of people in all kinds of sectors in Quebec is going on, particularly, supposedly it started off with the tattoo industry and then went into entertainment, the restaurant industry, and a bit of the crossover is Blanchet because, and I didn't know this, that he was a manager in the music industry when this story is alleged to have happened 21 years ago. So I guess everybody has different origin stories. I thought he is a media guy, isn't he? But he seemed to be managing this musician. And it turns out, and this is not to say anything about Blanchet directly, but the person that he was managing at that time, Eric Lapointe is the person's name. And when the incident, supposedly the night in question that happened, it was for the filming of a video with this guy. He is up on charges right now. He's awaiting trial on I believe it's an assault of a woman. I don't know all of the details. The information just started flooding once I started going down this rabbit hole, and it is a rabbit hole. But if you see this guy's video, the video that was filmed, I mean, it in itself belongs to a completely different era. I mean, it just reeks. It's, I don't know, coincidence or what, but it reeks, absolutely reeks of toxic masculinity. And the thing is, in Quebec, and I'm not saying that their entire star system is toxic masculinity, but I don't think people in Canada realize that they have a completely different channel of people that we don't necessarily see. There are times when somebody emerges, like a Blanchet, but I'm thinking in particular of Celine Dion, who went beyond the Quebec star system to go, she went international and she's the exception. So they have this whole world of stardom and people that we don't necessarily know of in the rest of Canada. And it sounds like this is blown wide open. There's like lots and lots of people on this list that have been called out to varying degrees. And as some of them seem to have stepped aside or stepped down, Blanchet, not yet, but remains to be seen.
Yeah, it's a real mess, and it shouldn't surprise. You know, we've had revelations. I mean, there's the big revelations from, you know, America, Hollywood. You have, you know, Harvey Weinstein, of course, the guy who ran CBS, Les Moonves, Louis C.K., Matt Lauer, down the list. And of course, there's been some of that here in Canada too. You know, Gian Gomeshi, the guy who was the front man for Headley. Headley's all but done now. So you got to figure, because as you said, the French celebrity culture is a vastly different ecosystem. Of course it would. It's, you know, French. So, you know, you're talking about people who are, you know, celebrities in French, and perhaps, you know, there's not the crossover that there should be. You know, you can enjoy French music without necessarily speaking the language. I know I certainly do. But having said that, it's really amazing how, I mean, it shouldn't be amazing at this point because we've sort of seen it happen before, but how it sort of snowballed and how it avalanched. This was basically a month ago those allegations against tattoo parlors started being posted. And then, as you said, it worked its way up to bartenders. Then it worked its way into musicians. And now it's worked its way all the way to the House of Commons with Yves-François Blanchet. Interestingly, Eric Lapointe is or was a judge on La Voix, which is, from what I gather, the French language version of The Voice, which is a singing competition. Mm-hmm. He is actually one of two of the four judges from La Voix who has been, accused of abuse. And I think in the case of Alex Nevsky, though, it wasn't necessarily misconduct with while on the job. It was allegations of abuse in a previous relationship. But having said that, part of the thing about La Voix and The Voice, if you know that show, is that the judges are also, in a sense, mentors. So mm-hmm. that when, these young people come on the show and audition and they are selected to take part in the competition, they are also mentored by one of the judges. And that's really concerning when half the judges on this competition show are now basically Me Too'd. It doesn't make you feel very good if you're a Quebecois and your son or daughter comes to you, talks about wanting to get into music.
Oh, absolutely. And this is the thing. I mean, we obviously have to believe survivors, but the way that this has evolved, mm-hmm. and I think it evolved because of the snail's pace to which these allegations are dealt with, that it takes so long. And enough people, women mostly, are fed up. Although I think there is one woman implicated in this, nothing verified. I guess some of the things are, but then all the amount that was kind of let go online. I think it was Instagram too. It was, victims' yeah. voices in the city just absolutely exploded.
To mention the one woman, we've seen that in the Me Too before as well. When you think of Asia Argento, who was mm-hmm. Abused by Harvey Weinstein and then was later accused of abuse one of her younger co-stars. It's not unusual to say that a victim then becomes a perpetrator, unfortunately, too.
Yeah, and I always thought, going back a bit in time, and I guess it might be a bit too late to judge because he has died now, I always thought it was strange that Celine ended up marrying her manager that started managing her when she was like 12 years old or something, right?
Right.
That always struck me as strange, but that is a separate thing. I don't know what's going to happen with Blanchette. He has said that whoever it is should go to what he called the competent authorities if they have this allegation that they should do that, and that he did say that he believes survivors. The thing is, the law is a little bit different in Quebec in that, if I understand it right, under Quebec law, you can be sued for libel even if what you're saying is absolutely true. So if you go online and say, so-and-so did this, and you haven't backed it up with anything, and it may or may not be true, it in all likelihood is, you can still be sued for that. So I think that's why Blanchette is saying, look, you need to come forward with this and go through the proper channels. And he did obviously seemed a bit broadsided by it rather than some of the other musicians in that who have just stepped aside or stepped down, or one had admitted to being, I had an alcohol problem. The usual things that come out when somebody has been accused of certain things, and everybody handles it differently. It sounds like the BQ are giving him unequivocal support. I don't think anyone has said we don't not support our leader, which was interesting. There was no blow. It wasn't the equivalent of an open letter, which seems to be all the rage these days, and open saying we support him and everything's an open letter now. So I wonder if this is something that's just going to go into simmer and then we're going to hear about it again. Now the burning question is it an attempt at political assassination, right? Because if this person isn't from the, whoever his political enemies are, or a Russian bot or whomever, I don't know. Has it emerged as to who, has anybody come forward to say that they are the person that made this allegation? Because I could not find it.
No, I couldn't find it either. And it's entirely possible. And
because that's the thing, like some of the people who have made these allegations have stepped forward. I mean, either anonymously or whatever, but there is a physical person that they can say, yes, I actually did say that. Whereas this one just seems to be out of the, into the ether and onto the internet. And as soon as it's out there, and it doesn't matter I mean, it does matter whether it happened or not, but if whether it did or didn't, you know that there are people that are going to look at him now and say, oh, yeah, it's totally understandable. It was like me looking up that video, and I was actually kind of shocked at this video. I would say it was on the verge of soft porn. And I know things are different in Quebec and France in general, the way they approach things, but it was very reflective. If you didn't know the backstory and just saw this thing, you'd say, you know what? Like, everything about this is wrong. So
the thing with Blanchet, if I just didn't, you know, there has been the one allegation. I think if there's one thing we've come to understand from, I guess, outcries is how I would phrase them, is that, you know, usually where there is one, there is more. And sometimes when you only get the one, like, I guess maybe Aziz Ansari is a good example, where there was kind of the one person who came forward and said, this is an experience I had with Aziz Ansari, and there was kind of no, there was no follow-up. Meanwhile, you know, think about all the allegations against Weinstein, where, you know, a couple of people went on the record with Ronan Farrow, and then all of a sudden the deluge comes, and that's how it is sometimes. And so, I mean, that adds another layer to this, another you know, difficult layer. Of course, we should all believe victims, but you know, if it's with these guys who are true predators, we know that it's not just one time. So,
well, yeah, and that, I mean, that's the thing, that there are shades too. There's Aziz Ansari, upwards to Louis C.K., and then there's Epstein, right? So there is varying degrees of. I'm not validating any of it by saying that, but it's you know, there is a range, right? So, and it's obviously for the courts to decide, but also for the you know, the people will stand in judgment. And if your career is ruined from that accusation, well, then your career is ruined from that. There's no real redemption. I guess you have I'm saying you, but that person has to find it somehow, if that is even possible, right? Like, you say Aziz Ansari, like, he's back, right? Like, he's, they have a Netflix special or something. Like, he's not, hasn't been relegated to the, you know, to just gone.
Or even Louis C.K. is
not like Gomeshi.
Well, yeah, and I mean, Gomeshi tried to make a comeback. But, you know, speaking of going through the system, I think it's also important to note that only 17% of sexual assaults in Canada are reported. And of those, only 10% result in a conviction. So even as we say, like letting the proper authorities sort things out, there's a long, sad, damning history of the proper authorities not sorting anything out, which is why people turn to Instagram.
Oh, for sure. Exactly. Well, let's hope that in Quebec, in their star system, whatever's going on there, they can get it sorted out sooner rather than later. You're listening to Open Sources here on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. We're here every Thursday from 5 to 6. We're going to take a bit of a break now, a bit of a breather to play some PSAs, a little bit of music, and we will come back with part 2 very shortly. And that was a little taste of Coup de Pirouette from her album Roses. I think I may have gotten that at Hillside. I'm not sure. This goes out to the Hillside people, the Hillside Weekend. That song is called Tu oublierais mon nom, which means you will forget my name. And it should be mentioned that Coup de Pirouette is actually one of the people that dropped her manager out of the fallout of the previous story that we were talking about there. And that just dawned on me now, but I meant to play that song because we're talking about Quebec and lots of overlap there. But anyway, so and for you Hillside types, I hope that's a little sort of snack for you, because there are things coming up on the weekend. It's obviously very deeply missed by town, and we're normally a sponsor and would normally be trying to give tickets away right now, which is normally really easy, but we're not doing that today, sadly. But check it out online. Go to Hillside. Festival.ca, and you can find out what the concerts are this weekend.
And Guelph Lake is open if you just want to go there and pretend.
You could do that. Just take your device and sit on the beach and watch what's going on and, I don't know, smell the algae. I don't know whatever is going on. Keep your distance, though, and wear a mask. Anyway.
Good save.
So there may have been people up at the beach today because they are not working because they're collecting the CERB. There seems to be an argument that I keep hearing, you've heard it too, that there are people out there that won't work, that won't go back to work because they're on the CERB. And it seems to me, Adam, that the majority of the stories that I've seen and heard about this, the people complaining about those that are taking the CERB, the $2,000 a month, and staying home rather than going out to work or back to the jobs that they had for whatever reason, whether they feel unsafe or they have children. The argument I've heard always seems to be coming from the angry restaurateurs, right? I don't know if you've seen the same thing, but the people that I hear that are whining about this the most, that there are people at home that should be out working, are people that run restaurants. I don't know if you've heard any different, but I tell you, like, it's just, I want to hear more of the story rather than just the guy who runs the restaurants. I can't find anybody. What have you heard on the Vine?
That's more or less what I heard. No, I mean, that's, you're right. That's one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about this, because I've been having serious flashbacks to the coverage of when the minimum wage went up. I guess, when was that, 3-4 years ago now?
Yes, under the long-lost Liberal government of Kathleen Wynne.
And I would see story after story about, like, here's this business leader or business person, this small business person who's, like, really mad the minimum wage is going up because it means more money out of his pocket, quote-unquote his pocket, and what he's going to have to do, and maybe he's going to cut hours, maybe he's going to close up shop. And it's been the repeat of the same thing again and again and again, but this time the bad guy isn't an increase in the minimum wage. The bad guy is the CERB. And we never hear, just in the minimum wage stories, we never heard from people making minimum wage what the benefit of an increase in minimum wage would mean to them. And just like we are not hearing from people like collecting the CERB and maybe why they are choosing to remain on CERB in lieu of going back to work. Is it a matter of them feeling unsafe? I have heard from business owners who saying, they're hearing from people who say, like, they would like to work a couple of times a week. They don't want to work a full work week. They want to, you know, take this, wait and see how things are in September, which I think is perfectly reasonable. And it's become a whole class struggle thing, because what are we talking about reopening now? It's shops, it's restaurants, it's other places where you have minimum wage workers. The places where you don't make minimum wage, places like the offices, the, you know, the banks, these sorts of things, like the skyscraper businesses, let's say.
Yeah.
A lot of those people are still working from home.
Yeah, and of course, with technology and the arrangement, I mean, well, you could obviously just get your food delivered, but the restaurant situation is you have to be there right now. This, I'm not sure if people realize this, and I was thinking about it this afternoon because I knew it's been a long time since I worked in a retail setting, a really long time, actually. And it sounds like things haven't improved too much. There is a different wage for servers than people think. Oh, it's minimum wage. It's not. The wage in Ontario for somebody who is a server is $12.20 an hour plus tips. Now, you think about it these days, the amount of tips you'd be getting is obviously going to be less due to physical distancing and the less capacity in the restaurant, less business all around. That's a reduction for you as well. There must be people that there's a certain tipping point where it's like, you know, if I just stay away and don't take any hours, and how much am I going to lose? But you would not only feel better, at least for the time being, but be like, okay, I'm not going to throw myself into this dangerous, crappily paid situation dressed like somebody who should be in an emergency ward to give some drunk guy a hamburger who's going to say, you're not a fan of a little COVID, are you? Like, because that's the impression I get. I've heard a couple of anecdotal stories like that where there are And again, the doctors and the medical experts who say it too, with the, you know, the bump in numbers that we've seen in places with restaurants, people drink, their inhibitions get reduced. And then there are people that will go to that place, beyond the anti-masker types, who will go to that place and are just like, yeah, nah, nah, you know, like everybody knows that voice. And everyone, we've both been in that situation where you're encountering that person who is just a doofus that doesn't get it, right? So is that worth the hassle? And I don't think it's the it's not just the CERB. This is a greater structural issue in terms of how well we treat minimum wage workers. And Doug Ford, whose numbers are like top of the charts right now, who was it that stalled the rise in the minimum wage from, it went up to 14. They're like, well, we're going to leave it at 14, but we're not going to go to 15 where it was intended to go. And why did they do that? To please the friends in all of the businesses that we've just talked about. You need to own that, right? You are supposedly the COVID savior of Ontario. But this aspect of it where, you know, the restaurants can't get help. If they wanted help, they could dip into other programs, including, and I've seen it. And I only know for certain that there were temporary foreign workers in this Tim's that I was in the GTA because of a discussion that was going on in the corner that I happened over here. I was like, whoa, really? That's, I had no idea that they're like entire Tim Horton franchises that were staffed by temporary foreign workers in the GTA, let alone in Ontario, right? So now whether that obviously with the borders being shut and whatever's going on right now, it would probably be difficult to do that. But we need to examine this beyond the, you know, when the CERB is over and when COVID is hopefully off of the earth, what do we do? Do we just go back to this setup?
Well, that's what's been happening because all the big grocery stores, Walmart, Loblaws, Sobeys, Amazon, they've all gone back to regular pay. There's no more hero pay. There's no more pandemic pay for these people who literally kept the economy afloat. All of a sudden, these people were essential workers and they needed to be treated properly. And it's like, well, now we're in stage three. Well, forget it. You don't need to be paid anymore. But I mean, that's sort of a key part of this, because there's always been in our economy this kind of push-pull. And you see it at the minimum wage level. And I certainly work with people who made this choice as well. And I don't necessarily condemn it. I do, however, understand it. Do they stay at home on disability and make more money than working a minimum wage job? Where, yeah, they have work and they I really do believe people want the dignity of work. But you know what? When it's the choice, do I make more money because of my disability, or do I make pittance, you know, actually working hard? You know, what's the choice? And it's the same thing with the CERB. And I would also add, too, that a lot of people who work in these minimum wage jobs never get paid vacation. Now they're getting a paid vacation.
And a couple more sick days because, you know, you might give somebody the COVID, right? To me, and it should be insulting to all working people, whether they're on the CERB or not, when the Westons and the Bezos, et cetera, and we're talking, this is high level stuff. This is beyond the restaurants. When they are literally raking in the billions because sales are up. Amazon, record high. Bezos, many, many more billions, not just multi-millions, billions and billions of dollars. And the Westons the same. And that's, well, you know, the emergency, we can't give you that extra $2 an hour. That is absolutely, well, almost dropped the B-bomb there. But you know what I'm talking about? Like, it's just, it is, That is the ultimate insult to say that, oh, we can't afford to pay you this. Although, you know, the warehouse is going to be like absolutely laden with COVID, and the same, you know, hasn't been as bad, at least out this way lately, in terms of supermarkets. But like, staff get this, staff get that. We've seen it with staff in the in retirement residences as well. The outbreaks that have been going on. The rate of pay in those places isn't particularly good either, all things considered. So it's like, we need a heavy duty examination of this post CERB and hopefully post COVID, when this vaccine they're talking about comes through for all of us. Here's
right,
hoping.
There's a part of this too, that takes in the long-term care people. There are a lot of minimum wage industries that are a lot of, I guess, a lot of industries that take advantage of minimum wage. And again, getting back to the coverage of this, no one talks about the discrepancy. It's like, if people are making more money being on CERB, should, like, in the idea of competition, right, then shouldn't you be offering them more money to make it worth their while to come back to work? And I understand that too, that businesses are feeling the crunch. I understand that perfectly well, but, you know, as, and this is purely anecdotal, right, but there's a restaurant downtown that the mayor promoted having a for want, a help wanted sign out, because of they're so busy taking advantage of the dining district area. And it's like, that's great, but if the problem is they can't find people to work, is it because people don't want to work? I'm more inclined to think not so much. Or is it the fact that people are being paid more to play it safe, take it easy, and wait for the worst to be over? As you know, isn't the incentive supposed to be offering more money to work as opposed to taking the quote unquote handout? It seems that we've taken out the middleman of actually paying more people more to work and just saying, well, why don't you just work?
Get back to work. Yeah, and that's if there was other incentives too. Like if they said, okay, you're going to eat for free rather than a discount. Those kinds of things. I mean, it's sort of monetary, but not exactly. I mean, what would that cost, right? And you can cut anyway, slice it. But if you added up CERB, let's just assume CERB was the minimum wage, right? It CERB equals what you get a year. It's still only 24 grand, right? Mm-hmm. Now you can work and top up your CERB to a degree, and I mean, and as people do in those industries, work 2-3 jobs, sometimes 4, and I've even heard 1 of 5. It's not that much. So hopefully this will be a bit of a reckoning for that industry to say, look, we really need to. And restaurants are a low margin industry, right? It's not, they're absolutely, not, yeah. They're not as, some of them are volume based like Tim's, and others are depend on liquor, which is the highest marked up thing on any, you know, please drink. So, so we can make some money. Yeah, it's a tough one, and I'm sure we will definitely be revisiting that in the next.
Well, before we do revisit it, I just want to make this point too about universal basic income, because the Parliamentary Budget Office put out a thing that said UBI running it for 6 months till the end of the year would cost between $47.5 to $96 billion, and they think at the by the time we get to the end of the CERB, it's going to cost $71.3 billion. And so I make this point because as we've seen the result the last couple of days of all the ethics inquiries into what happened with Wii and stuff, which of course was meant to be this thing to get young people money that they normally would have saved from summer jobs that they took up. And just thinking about, you know, all the trouble this caused, like government's now threatening to take back money that people, quote unquote, unlawfully got from the CERB. It's just like, how much money could we have saved from the beginning of this if the government had just said, you know what, everybody with a social insurance number, we're going to give you $1,000 a month till the end of this, or $2,000 or whatever, rather than going through the rigmarole of we're going to set up a program with we and it's going to be awesome. And
that's just getting worse and worse. Let's talk about that one. Let's talk about the we next week, because man, it's like every 10 minutes, something to every like news on the tens, like every 10 minutes, there's something happens with we, but
Yep.
So finally, we're going to talk a bit about the, well, I'm going to call the statue situation sort of like underplays what is going on here. Now, there were three people arrested in Toronto on the weekend who allegedly had splashed paint on, who did we have? Ryerson, John A., who is a very popular target these days, and Edward the Seventh, which is a statue that was moved from India to Toronto. And of course, this is to, I think, the main point they were trying to make was the Black Lives Matter points of, you know, we have a system of colonialism, anti-blackness, and white supremacy. Now, I saw the speakers that spoke in front of the painted pink statue made some good points. I don't think they were the ones that were arrested. The people arrested had paint and stuff on them, allegedly. But the speakers, it was very interesting because one of them said, kind of gestured to the statue and said, look, it took this to get you to show up today. We've written letters, we've done this, we've talked to so-and-so, and we there's no coverage. Bit of pink paint, and you people are here to speak to us. And I thought that was a really interesting point, because realistically, what is pink paint in the scheme of things, right? It's not, it's like sort of the call, not the call to arms, because it was definitely nonviolent, the call to attention to what's going on. And I thought that was a very succinct and very interesting way to put it. Because the other point this person made said, you're kind of lucky that this is all that we're doing, right? Because it could potentially be like the violent uprising that's being implied, like we've seen in the States, like that topic up the top, where it's like, the people that are protesting, it's all violence and it's all this, and you're gonna bring the country down. But it's really like, no, it's really just some paint, and we're gonna talk.
Yeah, yeah. I think Sandy Hudson, who's was the co-founder of Black Lives Matter Toronto, basically made that point that you're doing a lot to protect statues, but what are you doing to protect people? And I found it's interesting that it takes like paint being tossed on a statue to like get the story behind it, that this Edward VII statue at Queen's Park, which you can't miss it because it's this huge king on a horse, that it was originally in New Delhi, and then when they got their independence, India got their independence, it was moved to Toronto. Somebody paid for it to have it boxed up and sent to Toronto at their own expense, and then they tried to figure out what to do with it. And
this is a side note.
Didn't want it, the ROM didn't want it.
Yeah. Put it out the back. Because for years, just sort of anecdotally in terms of paint, for when I lived in Toronto, for years somebody was sneaking in and painting the horse's genitals, which was like, you walk by and be like, this, like, what's going on? You just, I think there was already a hate on for that statue in particular. And because they said Edward VII, I know Edward VIII, who was the one that abdicated in the 30s, was definitely racist, like, and aligned with Nazis. Not a good guy. But that's not the point. The point isn't to what degree was this person involved. As we know, John A. was. Egerton Ryerson was directly involved in the building of the residential school system, among other things. A Ryerson name change in the works? Maybe. I don't know. Like, that's a lot of stationery, but it sounds like they are eggs there. They didn't say they were examining a name change, but the president of Ryerson pointed out, it's like, well, we put a little plaque to the side to talk about this. He was kind of trying to say, like, look, we're really trying. It's like, so you've got this big statue, then this little plaque that says, oh, by the way, this guy, residential schools. I think we're going to get to the point where that's just not good enough, right? But again, I think the statue. We were talking about the statues. I don't know if the statues are the point. It's the dialogue that's the point, right? So we're obviously going to see more of this, right?
Well, the thing with the statues is that it's long been just like it's long been assumed. You throw up a statue to John A. Macdonald, he's the first Canadian Prime Minister, so it just makes sense. Slap him on the $10 bill. It's all cool. He's one of the founders of Canada. And what has been missing was the additional components. Like, what did it take for John A. Macdonald to be the first Prime Minister of Canada? And what did he do with that power? And that's always been the component missing. Yeah, he was the first Prime Minister and a father of Confederation. Great. That's worth knowing. But do we understand the whole picture? Do we understand the ways and mechanisms that our country was founded, mm-hmm. and that has to be reconciled. And, throwing paint on statues, I think, is a pretty, pretty benign way of reminding people that the privilege and status that some people enjoyed was often on the backs of other people who were never given consideration.
And then interestingly, we're kind of running out of time, but I wanted to get to it, the paint job under cover of darkness of the monument in Oakville to the Nazi division, which people have known about for a long time. So I should, a bit of the backstory, there is a monument in a private Ukrainian cemetery in Oakville, and the cemetery has been there for a long, long time, to the, I think it's the 14th Division of the SS Waffen, who were Ukrainians who sided, get this, true story, sided with, they became a Nazi division to fight communism. Now, they've somehow found some kind of redemption in Canada because they were fighting the Soviet Union, who were the allies of Canada at that point. Then, of course, when the war ended, it's like, well, we're fighting communism. In my book, and in a lot of people's books, it doesn't matter if you joined the SS for what you thought were the greatest intentions. A Nazi division is a Nazi division. There is no redemption in that. You could have found another way to fight communism or whatever the heck you were fighting in your own country. But to do this kind of revisionism, and part of this is because this isn't a public monument. It's not like Egerton, right? You go to Ryerson, you see Ryerson. You go to Queen's Park and you see Edward VII. This monument is in a private space. And the graffiti was so Canadian. Nazi war monument, right? That to me is the ultimate. That alone is a Canadian statement. It wasn't like F this or whatever. It was like Nazi war monument. And everybody lost it. But it's been brought to the fore again, which is good because it was smacked down the last time because it was the Russians who were supposedly trying to stir it up and troll the government by saying, well, look, you know, they've got a Nazi monument here in Oakville, Ontario. They've got one in Edmonton. And they said, oh, no, that's just the Russians stirring up. Don't worry about it. It doesn't matter who brought it to light. Still a Nazi monument. And it doesn't matter if it's on private or public property. If somebody puts up a swastika flag in their yard, which is private property, to me, and to a lot of people, that is the same damn thing. It has to go.
Well, the thing I did, first of all, I didn't know about this at all. This was news to me. So hearing about it, the other thing that struck me too was that this apparently happened around June 21st or after June 21st. So it was kind of, I don't know if this is the case, but that's what I kind of took from the articles I read, is that kind of like 3 weeks to a month went by without anyone going past this thing and seeing the words Nazi war criminal spray painted on it. No matter how long ago that was, which says to me that even if it was at one point meaningful to Ukrainians who emigrated to Canada, it's probably not terribly meaningful to the Ukrainian community in Oakville now. And that, you know, so you have that, and on top of that was just the immediate visceral reaction of Halton Regional Police putting out a statement like, yeah, we're investigating it as a hate crime. And people were like, what? You're investigating defacing of a Nazi monument as a hate crime? And it not only did the police itself have to retract the statement, but the chief of Halton Regional Police had to come out and retract it too.
Yeah, because said something to the effect of, it's unfortunate, the unfortunate part of all of this is that any such monument would exist in the first place. So they had to do this weird backtracking. It's like, oh, it's a hate crime. Oh, no, wait, it's Nazis. So it's not a hate crime. But it's, and then they had to do this whole sort of backpedaling stuff. And it was like, obviously no one will ever be charged. They'll probably clean it up. And under cover of darkness, somebody will dynamite it one night and we'll all be better off. It won't be me. It will not be me. I just, for the record, I said that on the air. I said, someone will dynamite it. It won't be me. I think it's pretty clear how I feel about it. I knew about it because I grew up in that area. And oh boy, do I love Oakville. Huh? Yeah.
Yeah. It's because, as you said, it's a private cemetery. So, and the mayor of Oakville appeared on Twitter and said, like, hey, I can't do anything. I'm just the mayor of Oakville and it's a private cemetery. So,
well,
somebody has to do something about this.
Absolutely, yeah. Including probably keeping the pressure on. Anyway, the pressure is off of us now because we have run out of time. Adam, where can people find out about you and what you do?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to GuelphPolitico.ca.
And I am Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and you can hear us every Thursday here on CFRU 93.3 FM. For open sources, please tune in next Thursday and every Thursday as long as the bunker has power, and we will be able to keep bringing you what we bring you every week. Thank you once again for joining us, and take care, wear your masks, and keep your meters.